Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. The Israeli Defence Forces, the IDF, has urged residents of more than 20 villages in southern Lebanon to evacuate as it continues targeting what it says are Hezbollah positions. For your own safety, said an army spokesman in a post on a social media site, you must evacuate your homes immediately and head north of the Awali River. Save your lives. In the capital, Beirut, in an airstrike overnight, an Israeli missile struck a health centre affiliated with Hezbollah. It was located in a residential area in the centre of Beirut. Hezbollah itself says that those who were killed were medics. Israel's issued a new call for civilians to leave the area. The BBC's Sally Nabil has been at the scene but has had to move away because of that Israeli warning. Sally joins us now. Sally, can you describe what you saw this morning?
It was a scene of chaos. It was a scene of fear and fury. A lot of the residents have been really angry because of the Israeli air raid last night. The medical center lies in a busy residential building. Now all the residents have left. The building has been heavily damaged. All around us we could see rubble and some blankets and some medical equipment like gloves and masks and so on. I've talked to one of the residents in the badly hit building, and he told me that as soon as we heard the air raid, we ran out of the building. Children were screaming. We felt as if our hearts are going to stop. And he wondered why a medical facility has been hit by an air raid. It's believed that this medical facility is Hezbollah affiliated. But what we've heard from the people there is that it has been serving everybody in the area. So this is why the people there were very angry. And the thing is, they don't know how they are going to spend their night, what the future holds for them. They might head to a center for the displaced in Beirut, or they might even stay in the street. In different parts of the capital here, you could see people staying out in the street because they've been displaced from either southern Beirut or southern Lebanon as a result of the constant Israeli airstrikes.
And Sally, the argument that Israel advances for these strikes in what is a very heavily built-up part of Beirut, is that this is a stronghold of Hezbollah, as well as the medical facility. Have you seen any evidence at all to kind of explain why this particular building might have been targeted? Any evidence of weapons, any evidence of anything that would indicate Hezbollah non-medical activity there?
We haven't seen any weapons or any military presence, but what we understand is that this medical facility is associated with Hezbollah, but we haven't seen any military presence around. And if you put forward the Israeli argument to the people there, they will be really upset. A lot of them have been very angry this morning, and it's not just about the airstrike, it's about what comes next, because they are just waiting for the unknown. It's a state of uncertainty here. We are talking about a really busy residential area. I've understood that this building that was hit by the Israeli airstrikes had dozens of families in it. So it's a really tough situation for many Lebanese at the moment, because they leave their homes and they don't know where to go.
Sally Nabil, in Beirut. Thank you very much. Well, Israel says it's killed around 50 members of Hezbollah in an airstrike on a building in Bint Jabil. That's in southern Lebanon. The BBC's Orla Guerin is in the southern city of Tyre, and she joins us from there now. Orla, can you give us an update of what's happening in the south? Because we've also had this warning, haven't we, for people to get out of villages in the area.
That's right. More people have been told to leave their homes, and many people here say they have nowhere to go and they have no means to travel. Many of those who have remained in outlying villages, and indeed those who have remained here in the city of Tyre, are people who are older, sometimes people who have sick relatives or people who just don't have the money to go somewhere else. And several people have said to us in recent days, where should I go? I don't want to sleep on the street. I would rather stay in my home. One man said to us this morning, I'd rather die at home than die somewhere else. Now, throughout the morning, Sean, we've been hearing explosions. That's very much the norm here. You hear the thud of Israeli airstrikes landing in areas outside Tyre. We have also heard volleys of outgoing rockets being fired from Hezbollah. And the IDF, the Israeli Defence Force, said this morning that in a one-hour period that Hezbollah had fired about 300 rockets. So for all that Israel is doing here on the ground and in the air, Hezbollah are continuing to fire. But just to bring you up to date on two fatalities in the last few hours, we now have two Lebanese army soldiers who have been killed in separate incidents, but both blamed on Israeli fire. The first was, according to the army, a strike on a military post in the town of Bint Jabail. Now, that is very much a Hezbollah stronghold, but the army is saying one of its troops was killed and that the soldiers stationed at the post returned fire. And the other was an attack on a joint operation being carried out by the Lebanese army and the Red Cross. It's in a town near Tyre, a place called Marjayoun. And they're describing that as a mission to evacuate, a rescue and evacuation mission. A Lebanese army soldier killed there too, and four Red Cross volunteers injured.
Orla, does this in any way change the dynamic of this incursion by Israel, that it's now ended up with some of the Lebanese army's own troops dying?
Well, certainly the Lebanese army will have been trying to stay well away from this conflict. It's not a participant in the conflict. The conflict is taking place between Israel and Hezbollah. But what we are seeing, Sean, in recent days is that anyone can be a target. We're seeing that in Beirut, where airstrikes have moved from the Hezbollah stronghold in the southern suburbs into the centre of the city. We've seen it very clearly here in Tyre, where we have been at the scene of four different airstrikes in recent days. Two of those were near hospitals and two were in residential areas. Now, there may perhaps have been a Hezbollah presence in or near those areas, but Israel is still not allowed under international law target a whole building or a group of people because they want to hit a Hezbollah target. And we went to one location 2 days ago in Sidon, where more than 45 people were killed. It was an apartment block of 32 flats which was brought to the ground. Now, we know there may have been a Hezbollah involvement there or near there, because Hezbollah was at the scene when we arrived. But we met many local people who said this was a building full of families, full of ordinary people, many of whom had in fact taken in those who were displaced from fighting in the south and who had come to the city of Sidon, which is about 40 minutes from Beirut, hoping that they would be safe. So the pattern that's emerging is that the range of locations being hit is widening. The range of people being told to move is widening. And Israel's operation, the invasion across the border, is moving deeper and deeper into Lebanon.
Orla Guerin in Tyre, thank you very much for that. And a little later in the programme, we'll be talking to former Minister of Foreign Affairs in Lebanon. to South Africa now with the killing of two black women who were allegedly shot dead and fed to pigs by a white farmer and two of his workers has caused outrage. The two women were allegedly gathering food on the farm near Polokwane in northern Limpopo province in August when they were shot. A state prosecutor says their bodies were given to pigs in an apparent attempt to dispose of the evidence. Our correspondent Nomsa Maseka reports from Polokwane.
Farm owner Zakaria Johannes Olifir, his employees Adrian Devet and William Mosura faced an angry community as they appeared in court on Tuesday. They stand accused of killing Maria Makhatu and Kudzai Ndlovu and then dumping their bodies in a pigsty. Inside the packed courtroom, the relatives of the victims and community members were demanding that the suspects be denied bail. The grim discovery of the partially devoured bodies happened in August. Families of the victims are still in shock. Ranti Makhatu is the eldest of Maria's four children.
My mother was brutally killed, and it's very painful for us. She was murdered, but finding her inside a pigsty is even more tragic. I think I'll sleep better if suspects are denied bail.
The murders of the two women led to protests outside the court in a country already plagued by high levels of violent crime. This has also led to stronger calls for legislation to combat racially motivated crimes. Matsunga Farisani is the head of the gender desk at the South African Council of Churches.
They're role modeling. What they're doing, they're role modeling even to their own children. That it's okay to kill a black person. A black person is not a fully fledged human being. You can go ahead and kill a black person. So that's what they were doing. You know? That's what they're doing. And it's a pity because they're doing it after the ushering in of the new dispensation. Some of people are saying, oh, 30 years down the line, we thought apartheid is over. Apartheid is not over yet.
The bail application was postponed to November to enable authorities to conduct further investigation. Mashudu Marabi Dzangi is the spokesperson for the National Prosecuting Authority.
Yes, we're going to oppose the bail. This is a serious offence. We're talking about two murder charges plus attempted one. And then we've got the defeating the ends of justice.
Is this a first for this province where you've seen such a gruesome type of murder?
No.
In relation to farm attacks or farm murders?
No, we had several cases where some they've been shot and then the accused were saying that the people will look like baboons or monkeys. So it's not for the first time even this type of cases here in Limpopo.
Would you say that some of these cases are perhaps racially motivated?
We can even think so, as we are saying that the victims are black people, and we're talking about women who have been killed here.
The suspects will remain in custody while families of the victims and the community wait for justice.
That's Nomsa Maseka reporting from Polokwane in Limpopo province in South Africa on a truly gruesome case we'll be following on the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour with me, Sean Lay, live from the BBC in London. Coming up, in a historic move, Britain has agreed to hand over the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean to Mauritius. One Chagos Islander, or Chagosian, tells us he still won't be able to go home.
My goal is one day to live on Jigogosha and to end my life there peacefully, stress-free. That's, I think, many Chagosians have the same dream as I, you know. Even my mom, before passing away, one of her last wishes was to go back and live on her island.
The latest headlines here on BBC NewsHour. Lebanon's army says two of its soldiers have been killed by Israeli fire as Israel continues its offensive against Hezbollah. And a fire in a hospital in southern Taiwan has killed at least 9 people as a typhoon batters the area. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. The US President Joe Biden was in the swing state of North Carolina late Wednesday, inspecting the damage from Hurricane Helene. Also with him is Vice President Kamala Harris. As the Democratic Party's candidate for president, Ms. Harris will be acutely aware of the potentially damaging impact on her campaign to succeed Mr. Biden in the election, which is just 4 weeks away, if the federal government is not seen to be playing its part in the disaster response. Almost a week after it made landfall in Florida, Helene has wreaked havoc across 6 states in the southeast of the United States. At least 170 people have died, but it's rural communities in North Carolina that have been hardest hit. Some have seen the place they call home all but wiped from the map. Our correspondent Carl Nassman reports from the ground.
It was a terrifying moment.
As floodwaters rushed just under the windows of her mobile home, Nancy Berry knew she needed to evacuate fast.
My little great-niece, she carried my medicine and got my pocketbook up on its little head, and she had a hold of me. And she was just pushing me, pulling. And that water was... you didn't know what was going to happen next.
The 77-year-old waded through the floodwaters to a boat and made her way to a local shelter. Now, with the waters gone, Ms. Berry has returned to her home near Boone, North Carolina. Several fans buzz in an effort to dry things out and salvage what remains.
All that's gone.
Mattress.
Yeah. I'm trying to get... They've tried to put stuff on the bed.
She wasn't the only one taken off guard by the sheer power of the storm. Many of her neighbors' cars are still parked outside, covered in mud. There simply wasn't time to drive to safety. Hurricane Helene intensified rapidly from Category 1 to a Category 4 storm, striking Florida's coast, then sweeping across America's southeast. Here in North Carolina's mountainous west, up to 5 months' worth of rain fell in just 2 days. Water rushed down valleys and canyons, wiping out entire communities. In North Carolina alone, at least 89 people have died. That's nearly half of the total victims. On Wednesday, President Biden flew over the region to survey the damage.
And just imagine what it must have been like sitting along those rivers and streams as all that rain came down. What, 19 inches of rain, something like that? Incredible amount of rain. Watching homes, you could see homes that are moved from clearly from one side of the river down the river to another side of the river. And I can only imagine what it's like to have been in one of those homes.
He also announced a surge in financial aid and up to 1,000 additional troops to help the state's recovery effort, news that will be welcomed in the town of Banner Elk in the Appalachian Mountains. Tyler Burr is the local fire chief. He says his teams, even days later, are still combing remote areas for stranded and missing residents. Federal aid has yet to arrive.
Put it bluntly, sometimes we feel like the stepchildren of the country in a lot of ways. If I'm being candid as possible, I'm afraid we're one celebrity headline away from being fallen completely off the map as far as attention, that kind of thing.
But locals here have been doing their best to fill in the gaps.
Come on, we do it together. One, two, three.
Working together, even amid a bitter presidential campaign.
I'm in Statesville, North Carolina. We're in the western part of the state, about an hour or so away from the worst affected regions here. And there is a group of volunteers gathered to bring supplies to those who really need them most. There's a room here that had been filled with things like diapers, bottled water, food, canned goods. And this is all now making its way onto a very large semi-truck that's going to now drive into Buncombe County, and that is really one of the epicenters of this disaster.
Back in Boone at the mobile home park, rows of homes, including Nancy Berry's, are beyond repair, and many residents don't have flood insurance. Even as they recover from the storm, a financial disaster could be looming.
Carl Nasman reporting there from North Carolina. Well, despite the impact of Hurricane Helene and similarly destructive weather events across the US in this election year, people seem reluctant to discuss climate change much, which scientists agree is making these events much worse, in the election campaign itself. Might descriptions like this one by Mayor Peter O'Leary, speaking to me late yesterday from what's left of the village of Chimney Rock in North Carolina, have an impact on American perceptions?
It's kind of a beautiful sight in the sense that it's this big, wide riverbed. But what's terrifying is that it used to be five times smaller than that. And so you realize that where that huge new riverbed is, there used to be shops and homes, and a lot of them are gone.
Well, joining us now is Naomi Oreskes, who's Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. Professor Oreskes, thank you for being with us on NewsHour. Why isn't it a bigger issue in the campaign?
Well, it's a long and complicated story, but the short version is that for more than 20 years, the fossil fuel industry and its allies have poisoned the well of public debate by deliberately seeking to create confusion about how climate change is making extreme weather events worse, and deliberately polarizing it, aligning the Republican Party with a climate denialist position, so that now if you talk about it, it's seen as politically partisan, it's seen as divisive and polarizing, and so it's become a kind of third rail for candidates from both parties.
So even those Democrats who profess to believing man-made climate change and say they're committed to doing something about it are afraid of talking about it?
Well, in my world, we don't talk about believing in climate change. We talk about accepting the facts of climate change. But yes, exactly. They're afraid to talk about it because they're afraid of antagonizing the swing voters. And remember, in the United States, the presidential election isn't decided by the base of either the Democratic or Republican Party. It's decided by the independents and other swing voters. So they're afraid of antagonizing those people. And so the tendency is to focus on things that they see as politically safer, like what I'm going to do about the economy, how I'm going to create jobs, how I'm going to get inflation under control.
Do you get any sense? I mean, a good example of that was probably the big kind of landmark legislation, wasn't it, that was introduced early in the Biden administration, which had a lot of climate-related initiatives, but was kind of trumpeted as being about the economy and about jobs and about kind of domestic independence from competitors.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's the proof of the case, that the fact that that bill was called the Inflation Reduction Act rather than the Climate Crisis Act or the Climate, you know, Impacts Reduction Act just proves the point.
Do you, I mean, I know you're clear about your position on this. Do you get a sense in any sign that perhaps American public opinion is a little ahead of the strategists and the campaigners and the people in the political machines?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we see that on many issues. I think we see it historically that, you know, often leaders don't really lead, they follow. And particularly politicians are very sensitive to public opinion. And on some level, that's right. They should be sensitive to what their constituents think. But they're desperately afraid of getting too far out in front, of getting ahead of their constituents. And this particularly applies again because of the electoral college system in the United States. We have these key swing states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nevada. And so the candidates are super sensitive about what people in those states say. And if those people are not ready or are thought to be not ready to hear a strong statement on climate, they won't make that statement. No, I think that's wrong. I mean, I think that actually the American people, by and large, when we have lots and lots of public opinion polls that show that the American people, by and large, you know, do know that this is real and want the government to act on it.
Naomi Oreskes, Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University, thank you very much for joining us on NewsHour. What was that French revolutionary leader once quoted as saying? I am their leader and must follow them. You're listening to the BBC World Service and NewsHour. Welcome back. Coast Guards off the coast of Djibouti on the Horn of Africa have been searching for more than 100 people who were forced to jump off their boat by the very people they paid to smuggle them across the water. 310 people were on board the vessels. At least 45 bodies have already been recovered. The International Organization for Migration, the IOM, says the number of those drowned makes 2024 the deadliest year on the migration route between East Africa and Yemen. Yvonne Ndege, the IOM spokesperson in the region, has been telling me what happened. But first, I asked her to explain why Djibouti has become so important to those who make a profit from the smuggling of people.
This migration route is known as the Eastern Route, and it runs from the Horn of Africa to Yemen and the Gulf. Predominantly, the migrants come from countries like Somalia and Ethiopia, and they hope to reach the Gulf nations, mainly in search of work. In order to do that, they have to pass through Djibouti because these countries don't have direct access to the sea. And Djibouti obviously has a coastline. They cross the Gulf of Aden to Yemen and traverse through Yemen to try to reach the border with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which they hope to cross over to and then move into the Gulf countries. These migrants often leave their homelands. They spend weeks, in some cases months, on foot trying to reach Djibouti to make those crossings. And on the way, they are often targeted and exploited by people traffickers and smugglers who they have to pay, obviously, to get them across to Yemen and onto the Gulf.
So these people will have paid to be given the vessels to get across the Gulf. But last night they were actually forced off precisely by the people who they'd paid to get them across.
It's highly likely that these migrants would have been forced to pay sums of money to reach, first of all, Yemen. But what we have found is that many migrants can't actually complete that journey, and they find themselves stuck in Yemen, sometimes for weeks, sometimes for months, and they have to pay traffickers and smugglers to try to return home. So this particular tragedy that we're talking about involves migrants who were trying to return, most likely, to Djibouti with the view of maybe later on try again to reach the Gulf, and in some cases to try to actually reach home.
What do you understand about what happened then last night?
According to survivors in Obok, which is just off the coast of Djibouti, and what those who survived and witnessed this tragedy say is that as these vessels were approaching the Djiboutian coast, in the middle of the water, the smugglers forced many of the migrants to disembark, to jump off the vessels. Subsequently, many of them could not swim, hence the tragedy, hence this death toll. There is massive overcrowding on many of these vessels. In previous tragedies, vessels have been about to sink or about to capsize, and migrants have been forced or pushed off these vessels.
That's Yvonne Ndege from the International Organization for Migration, a UN agency, talking about the mass drowning which took place overnight on Tuesday into Wednesday. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. Now, 200 years after the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean were ceded to Britain by France, and nearly 60 years since the British leased part of the islands to the United States to build a military base, Britain has announced that it's agreed to hand over sovereignty to Mauritius. The deal ends a diplomatic standoff, but it does not resolve the demand of those who were expelled to make way for the US military base on the island of Diego Garcia to return home. That's because America's lease runs until the middle of this century and is unaffected by the transfer of sovereignty. The United States argues that Diego Garcia is of huge strategic importance. With me in the NewsHour studio now is the BBC's Andrew Harding, who himself has been to the Chagos Islands. Andrew, give us a sense of what makes them so special and why this agreement is so significant.
One island, one atoll, the biggest one, Diego Garcia, is really at the heart of all this. I mean, they are spectacularly beautiful, remote paradise kind of tropical islands spread out across a huge chunk of Indian Ocean, just south of India itself. But Diego Garcia, since the late 60s, when Britain cut a secret deal to hand over the islands, essentially, to the Americans, has been the base for a big, important American naval, military, submarine operation with long-range bombers taking part in Afghanistan, Iraq and other conflicts, and very much a place that America uses to project power forwards into, you know, a tricky part of the world. And so the assumption had always been that America would make the decision on what happened to this island. Mauritius has been for years pleading, trying to influence global opinion, but nothing really shifted for a long time. And then just in the last decade in particular, Britain started to lose momentum. It's the world became more complex, that the post-Cold War era kind of, all those straightforward balances of power began to be disrupted. Then came Brexit, and Britain increasingly under pressure because it increasingly found itself isolated at the UN, at the General Assembly.
So it needed allies in places like Mauritius and other
And Africa neighbors. In particular. I mean, Africa started, you know, before it used to get picked off at the General Assembly by different former colonial powers and influences and so on. Increasingly, Africa is projecting a united voice and power, and it started saying to Britain, you know, you want support in Ukraine. You want support for this and that, but look at you ignoring International Court of Justice rulings, even if they're non-binding. You used to be part of an order that respected that.
Now, in terms of this particular deal, there is this critical question about the status of the people who used to live on the island until the military base was built. Jonathan Bowell, who was an advisor to the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, said what we did in the 60s was wrong. We treated them shamefully. But are they really going to get anything out of this deal?
The older generation, those who were forced off the island, most of them are getting old. They would like to go back more. Some talk of resettling. I went back with a group who with tears in their eyes, spoke of, you know, just wanting to go back to their homeland and their paradise. In reality, the logistics, the costs will be huge. And Mauritius and Britain are talking about supporting that. But it's going to be, I think, a long and messy process.
Andrew Harding, thank you very much. Well, Frankie Bonton is from the organisation Chagossian Voices. They describe themselves as a platform for all Chagossians, managed by a group of community volunteers and allies. Many of those who used to live on the island and their descendants are dispersed between the Seychelles, Mauritius and the UK. Frankie is a second generation. His mother was born on Diego Garcia, one of the islands in the Chagos archipelago. He gave me his response to today's news.
I think like the vast majority of Chagossians, even here in the UK and around the world, we are very disappointed. We are a bit angry. We feel betrayed. We feel let down because we feel that our opinion and views has no value whatsoever to both the UK and the Mauritian government. Because since this negotiation started in November 2022, at any moment Chagossians have been involved in this negotiation. While they're talking about the future sovereignty of the island, excluding the people which are at the center of this whole tragedy, which are the Chagossian people themselves.
Does it make any difference to you and your campaign whether the islands are internationally recognized as British or Mauritian?
You know, like Chagossian Voices, we've been campaigning. We went to the UN, to the MRIP, to the Indigenous Forum. We were campaigning for the right to self-determination. And what we were saying is like, it's not us like Chagossian Voices. We're campaigning for the Chagossian people, the community, to have a right, a say in the future. Let them decide whether they want the island to stay British or to be ceded to Mauritius or perhaps to be self-governed. But the people should be at the heart of any decision, you know?
At the heart of all this for the last 60-odd years has been the military base that was built on Diego Garcia. That was the reason that your mother and others of her generation were forced to leave the islands. Is that really the most important thing for you, to have the right to go back to the island?
Yes. You know, even the base, we know the importance of the base. Even if we are allowed back, we're not saying that the base should close. It's an opportunity for us to get job there, and we want to live on our homeland. I don't think we, like Chagossians, are any threat to the U.S. military facility. There are already people working there from the Philippines, and I don't think that Chagossians will be any threat. Like myself, my goal is one day to live on Chagossia and to end my life there peacefully, stress-free. That's, I think, many Chagossians have the same dream as I, you know? Even my mom, before passing away, one of her last wishes was to go back and live on her island. But unfortunately, she passed away like 2 weeks ago. And it's very sad. And like her, there are lots of natives who dreamt about one day to live on their island, which unfortunately didn't happen.
I'm sorry to hear about your mother's recent death. Yeah. Presumably this deal, though, would not actually lead to anyone going back to the islands. As far as we can tell, that remains a matter now for Mauritius, just as it was a matter for the British.
Yeah, but even when the government ask KPMG to do a feasibility study in the year, I think, 2011. At that time, they said, like, if resettlement, there will be resettlement on the island, it should be on Diego Garcia, where there are all the amenities. Like, the outer island is quite remote, and for the last 50, 60 years, it's been abandoned. This would cost lots of money to build, like, an airstrip or any harbor there. There are nothing on the outer island. I can't see how Mauritius going to pour out billions of rupees in there for resettlement.
Do you think today's agreement between Mauritius and the British strengthens or weakens your case?
I think it's weakened our case because, as I explained earlier, we've been completely excluded from this negotiation. While we understand this is between two governments, but they should have a mechanism where they could include the Chagossian, because at the heart of the Chagossian tragedy is our people itself. You know, when in 1965, when Mauritius, during the Lancaster House Agreement, when Mauritius would be granted independence in 1968, they decided, like, Mauritius was granted independence on the Chagossian suffering on our people, and the UK created Bayeux. And that is the start of our people suffering, where we'll be forced, exiled, dumped in Mauritius and the Seychelles. And today, we feel that the same thing happened, perhaps as been described by one of the official British officials at that time. Perhaps they still think like Chagossian because of their skin color. They are still Tarzan on Man Friday. They don't have anything to say about the future of their island. I'm not a racist, but that's my feeling sometimes, you know. For them, perhaps we are nothing. We are just like those Tarzan on Man Friday, how they describe in the declassified document in the 1960s.
That's Frankie Bontom from the organisation Chagossian Voices, responding to the news that Britain and Mauritius have agreed a sovereignty deal over the Chagos Islands. Up to 100,000 newborn babies in England are to be screened for dozens of genetic conditions. The sequencing of each child's whole genome usually involves taking blood from the umbilical cord soon after birth. The work has already started with 500 babies at 13 hospitals around the country. Dr. Sarah Bowden is the medical director of the East Genomic Laboratory Hub, which is based at the world-famous Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge, and she explained to me the scope of this study.
The project is a newborn screening programme which aims to look for over 200 rare conditions and ultra-rare conditions that can affect very few babies in the UK, but when it does affect them, it can have devastating impacts on that baby and child's health, and often it can impact the longevity of that child as well.
At this stage, it's a study, isn't it? But how quickly do you hope it could actually be used clinically?
So I think the answer to that very much depends on what the outcome of the study, whether the study shows that there are more benefits of whole genome sequencing for screening than there are risks. Not only does it have to be beneficial to the babies, but it also has to be acceptable to parents. And we have to be able to deal with the output of this in the NHS in an equitable way as well. So in an ideal world, if it was really beneficial, the NHS would be able to adopt this technology in the next sort of 3 to 5 years' time for the benefit of newborn screening.
The numbers are large, aren't they? Is there anything on this scale being attempted yet anywhere else in the world?
Yes, there is actually. So in the United States, there's a project called the BabySeq project that's been going for a number of years. And there's about to be another project started to sequence 100,000 babies called the Guardian project as well in the USA. And in France next year, they're starting a similar project. I'm not sure of the numbers in France, but they are launching in 2025 to look at whole genome sequencing in the newborn population.
There's a big push in the UK, as there is in other countries, to find ways of delivering more effective healthcare, more preventative healthcare, in some ways because it's cheaper, but also more importantly because it prevents people going through the agonies of some of these conditions and indeed having their lives shortened in some cases. Do you hold out hopes for this as a kind of shift in the way we treat health conditions, more about prevention than about treatment?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you can already see that when we're applying this technology already on a clinical basis in the NHS, we're often doing it for babies in neonatal intensive care units where they've already presented with some severe disorders, for example, severe epilepsy conditions, unable to breathe, for example. And so we're diagnosing babies at a very young age with conditions that may or may not be treatable already. But if we can actually predict those babies that will go on to develop conditions that are currently only treatable before they actually develop symptoms, then we'll actually be able to give them the treatments before they start to become symptomatic. And in that respect, we'll only see the benefits of this once we start to prevent the symptoms from occurring. And I think we'll be preventing many, many thousands of children from going through diagnostic odysseys that can take years. And sometimes at that point, the condition is no longer treatable and potentially is fatal. So I do hold out a huge amount of hope for this technology.
Dr. Sarah Bowden from the East Genomic Laboratory Hub at Addenbrooke's Hospital in England, talking to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC studios in London. And back now to our top story this hour, the ongoing Israeli operation in Lebanon, with strikes against targets in Beirut and in the south of the country. There are also reports that two Lebanese army soldiers have been killed by Israeli army fire. As Ola Gerin was telling us earlier in the programme, the Lebanese military had tried to stay out of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. But what should its political leaders do, not least given that a foreign military is back on its soil? Well, Tariq Mitri is a former acting foreign minister, among other cabinet roles he's held. He's also now an academic at the American University of Beirut. Professor Mitri, thank you very much for joining us on NewsHour. Tell us, if you could, from your perspective, what the last 24 hours have been like in your city.
Well, the last 24 hours, we've had airstrikes continue unabated. And while we're told that they target Hezbollah and its various institutions, it's mostly civilians that have been killed, civilians have been displaced, homes of civilians have been destroyed, and most Lebanese, those who lived through the war in 2006, and I'm one of them, fear that while Israel claims it is here to degrade or weaken or dismantle Hezbollah, in fact, it's waging an all-out war of destruction against Lebanon. We have a million Lebanese out in seeking shelters throughout the country. We have parts of Lebanon and the south in particular where people have been displaced from their villages with no perspective of being able to return. We've heard recently that the Israeli incursions in southern Lebanon have created a de facto a kind of buffer zone, empty of population, a kind of black buffer zone, where there not only no people left, but no trees and are left.
You will know the argument that Israel advances very forcefully and repeatedly is that it can only have security if it no longer receives the bombardment from Hezbollah. And there are plenty of people in Lebanon who do not regard themselves as fans of Hezbollah. What can they do?
Well, those in Lebanon who did not necessarily support the policies and practices of Hezbollah has tried in a country where we have a weak government, in a way dysfunctional, yet most people favored a diplomatic solution, and I think there was a diplomatic solution. The full implementation of Resolution 1701.
And which you were involved in negotating back in 2006. But the essence of that was that Israel would get out, but Hezbollah would end its assaults against Israelis over the border. That changed after what happened on the 7th of October last year and Israel's response. How do you uncouple those two things?
You know, for 17 years, with the exception of Israeli violation of Lebanese airspace, which is a violation of 1701, the area south of the Litani was quiet, and there was no violation of the blue line. There were no military operations against Israel of any sort during the 17 years. Now, after October 7th, in solidarity with the people of Gaza, Hezbollah has launched what had been a calibrated sort of military operation, and there was a tit for tat for almost a year, where Hezbollah and the civilian population of the south lost far more casualties than those on the Israeli side, and there were more refugees from southern Lebanon than from. And the only way to stop that, Hezbollah at that time said, was to have a ceasefire in Gaza. Now, short of having a ceasefire in Gaza, renegotiating the implementation of 1701, sending the Lebanese army to fill in the vacuum that will be created by the withdrawal of Hezbollah forces from where they are might be the solution.
I just wanted to pick up, and forgive me for interrupting you earlier, but I just wanted to pick up your point about, you know, there are fewer casualties. That is a statement of fact, but equally, you can understand, can't you, that for an awful lot of Israelis living under perpetual bombardment doesn't feel very safe. You may not die, but you fear to die, and fear is a very powerful and very destructive thing.
Of course, and I mean, to provide security for people on both sides of the blue line, whether it's in northern Israel or in southern Lebanon, because the population of southern Lebanon needs security as well, and they have been living in fear for generations. You know, the number of people who've gone through the wars in 78 and 96 and 82 and 2006, they also need, they have the right to security and assurance. And I think the fair, the honorable way out of this is full implementation of 1701 with stronger international, with more teeth, international guarantees, more teeth to the United Nations interim force, and the sending of the Lebanese army into southern Lebanon. I cannot see what other solution. Would Israel occupy southern Lebanon? I think that's a recipe for a 10 years war. I can't see what else is possible.
Just in the last few moments we have, can I ask you, there is this move, a renewed move to finally elect a president for Lebanon. Would you be willing to be put forward as a possible compromise candidate for that post?
Well, let's hope the various Lebanese parties are reasonable enough to agree on a compromise candidate. The tragedy of Lebanon's democracy is that there's no majorities and minorities. Yeah, you have to reach consensus, and short of reaching consensus, your institutions are blocked. I'm deploring that, but the fact of the matter is, unless we have a candidate acceptable to all, we won't be able to elect the president. And I think it's an urgent matter.
Professor Tagliucci, former acting foreign minister of Lebanon. Thanks for talking to NewsHour.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.